stone. Now I understand the note from Mr. Lipset on Bavarian Illuminati stationery. Commodore Newton, I suppose Miss Ephron should go first since she will be on the attack. might comment that Russ Bensley, who you'll hear from right now, won an Emmy this year as testimony to his skill in his field as producer of the CBS News documentary, The World of Charlie Company, and we'll hear from him now. Russ Bensley.
I thought you wanted a microphone.
No. I've had it for years.
Let me answer the last part of Miss Ephron's argument first, because I think we have some common ground there. I think she is probably correct when she states that a majority, at least, of network newsmen are liberally oriented, in the sense that all of us understand that word. That is, they have a political bias that is somewhat left of center. How far left of center depends on the individual. I think that's true. It's been true in my experience, not only with television journalists, but with newspaper, magazine journalists, with people in the media in general. And I think it would be naive to deny flatly that a degree of political bias on the part of the media exists. It is one thing to admit the existence of a bias and something else to admit the exercise of a bias. And this, I think, is the point at which Miss Ephron and I are likely to disagree some. A good professional journalist, and I'm talking about a journalist who strives towards objectivity as opposed to the new breed of advocacy journalists, but a good journalist will try to isolate his biases by first recognizing them and second, consciously compensating for them in the exercise of his professional skill. To the extent that he does that, he is doing his job right. To the extent that he doesn't do that, he's not doing his job right. And this, I think, is what we get into argument about, whether or not, by and large, on the whole, network newsmen are consciously compensating for their biases and doing what could reasonably be defined as an objective job of journalism. I would also be naive to deny that bias ever surfaces in network news presentation or in any news presentation, because we are dealing with journalists of varying degrees of skill, and we are dealing with people who are human beings. My thesis is that bias does not reflect itself in the presentation of the news to anything like the degree that Ms. Ephron suggests. And I want especially to disabuse you of the idea that her book proves anything. Our thesis is that Ms. Ephron's book does not prove anything at all, and there are a number of reasons for that, and I'll go through a few as I have time. Ms. Ephron's book pretends to be a scientific survey of network coverage of the 1968 campaign, and on the basis of that survey, she produces a number of statistics, a number of bar graphs, which purport to indicate that our coverage was biased towards the left, towards the liberal side in the coverage of that campaign. I'm going to discuss some flaws with her procedure. They may not convince you that her conclusions are wrong, but I think they may convince you that there are serious and perhaps fatal flaws in the procedure by which she compiled her book. The most important flaw, and the one that really permeates her entire study, is in the classification of material. All of her statistics depend upon the classification of broadcast material into various categories: pro-Nixon, anti-Nixon, pro-Humphrey, anti-Humphrey, for this issue, against this issue. In other words, somebody had to sit down there and say, this is a pro-Humphrey statement, this is an anti-Humphrey statement, this is a pro-black militant statement or opinion, this is an anti-black militant opinion. It should be on the record here that all of those judgments, all of those classifications, were made by one person. They were made by Ms. Ephron. This, by itself, is a violation of what I understand to be one of the cardinal principles of content analysis, which is the coding is not done by one person. There must always be two or more people cross-checking the coding. The theory being that if one person is doing all the coding, it is possible for that person's own bias to influence the classification of material. And this, we suspect, is what has happened with Miss Ephron. In any event, there has been only one coder of all her material. She has argued, when confronted with this argument in the past, at least on the Buckley Show, that it's a fairly simple matter to say this is a pro-Nixon statement, this is an anti-Nixon statement. There's no great sophistication to it. And one person can do that as capably as a panel of persons. Our thesis is that it doesn't work that way. And I will offer you a few examples of her classification to illustrate what we're talking about, to illustrate why a study like this cannot be valid unless several people are involved in cross-checking each other on the classification of material. I'm going to read you a statement, and I want you just to think in your own minds as to whether this is a pro-conservative statement, an anti-conservative statement, or a neutral statement. This is a statement by Hubert Humphrey, and I quote, "The Rap Browns, the Stokely Carmichaels, the extremists of the left and the right will not have their way, and we will not allow them to terrorize or stampede America or cause us to lose our sense of perspective." Is that pro-conservative, anti-conservative, or neutral? Miss Ephron classifies that as an anti-conservative opinion because, she says, Humphrey attacks extremists of the right for violence. Well, Humphrey did indeed attack extremists of the right for violence. Miss Ephron is equating that with an anti-conservative statement, which means that to the extent there are conservatives in this room, she considers all of you extremists of the right. I do not consider conservatives to be extremists of the right, and yet that goes down as an anti-conservative statement by Hubert Humphrey. We don't think it is. We disagree with her evaluation. I'll read you another one. This was a report by a CBS reporter, and I want you to decide whether this was pro or anti the white middle class. "From Pennsylvania, Muskie flew to Michigan, and there in Taylor, a white middle class suburb of Detroit, he was heckled by supporters of George Wallace. Correspondent Herman reports that he handled them with as much aplomb as he handled college students." Is that pro white middle class, anti white middle class, or neutral? Pardon? Miss Ephron. Miss Ephron describes that as an anti-white middle class editorial by the reporter, and she says in her description of it in her appendix, "The reporter attacks the white middle class as racist." Well, you know, think about it. He didn't do anything of the sort. He said that Muskie was appearing in a white middle class suburb and was heckled by Wallace supporters. To get it's anti what?
That's why it's an anti statement.
But it is not an anti white middle class statement. It is reporting an event that happened.
Yes, it is. It's
Smith. Does everybody here really believe that's an anti white middle class statement? Yeah. Do you really?
It is
a reporting of a fact. We do not mention racist. We said he was heckled by Wallace supporters, which he was. We said it was a white middle class suburb, which it was. Well, okay, you know, you're entitled to your opinions. I disagree that Miss Ephron's classification was correct there.
I don't really think it's fair to interrupt Mr. Benson's presentation at this point.
Well, let me go through. We'll argue about it later, okay?
And we're not going to have a debate here today either. We're going to have a presentation by two people, and then we'll get an opportunity as individuals to ask questions of the two of them. I think it'll be
okay. I'll give you one more example. All I'm trying to prove at this point is that reasonable people might well disagree with some of the classifications. The point I'm trying to make is that there should have been more than one person classifying. This one is either pro or anti student leftists. In a real sense, she says, the Wallace movement, I don't know who the reporter was on this one. It was a CBS reporter, and I don't know who it was. "In a real sense, the Wallace movement represents a class struggle, an uprising against what he calls the pseudo-intellectuals, professors, preachers, and everything that is big. Government, taxes, ownership, the big press, the big networks, the Negro movement, the left-wing student movement. All this is summed up in the word they. It is them against us. And, says Wallace, there are more of us than them. Ms. Efron classifies that as a pro-left editorial statement because she says the reporter describes left-wing student movement as one of the biggest institutions in the country. Well, he doesn't describe it as one of the biggest institutions in the country. He includes it in a list of big things that Wallace is against. Ms. Efron just 5 minutes ago finished telling you that it was a big year for the new left and that what was happening in the new left was big news. And yet she classifies our inclusion of the leftist students in that list as a pro-left editorial. Well, maybe I'm wrong. You know, maybe you disagree with me, but I think she's really reaching for things. And we disagree. I've got a list of about 15 of them here and a mess piled up back in the office. Things where we think she has been unfair in her classification of material. And unfair to a large enough degree that we think it renders her figures relatively meaningless. Now, you might say, okay, but the reader can certainly decide this for himself. He can see the original statements, you know, and compare them with Ms. Efron's evaluation and reach his own judgment as to whether the book is fair or not. Well, the fact of the matter is he can't. In most cases, Ms. Efron has not seen fit to publish the original material. She publishes her description of the original material, but the original text is not there. So that means that if you take one of the examples I just read, if you take Hubert Humphrey attacking the extremists of the right and read her description of it, which is that, you simply have no way of cross-checking her evaluations with the original material because it's not there in the book. And that's one of the things that disturbs us very much, too. Beyond the classification, and we think the classification of material is bad enough to invalidate the book right there. But beyond that, there are a number of other things that disturb us. For one thing, Ms. Efron's tables, her statistics, measure only statements of opinion, and only statements of opinion on a selected group of issues, that is, the candidates themselves and a selected list of issues, some of which were not issues in the campaign, some of which were. That means that anything that is said by or about the candidates in the course of that campaign was not an expression of opinion on those subjects, is not reflected in her figures. We could have had Richard Nixon on for a half hour talking about anything besides her selected list, and it wouldn't show up anywhere in her figures. We could have any candidate talking about God and mother and apple pie or handshaking or kissing babies, and it would not appear in the figures. In other words, her figures are in no way a reflection of the exposure given the candidates in the course of the campaign. Beyond that, she's had criticism, and indeed she has. She has left out of her selected list of issues, issues that were quite significant in the campaign. Nowhere in her figures, nowhere in those graphs, is there anything about economic issues. Nowhere is there anything about inflation. Nowhere is there anything about the plight of the cities. Nowhere is there anything about farm problems or labor problems or taxes. None of that. Anything that was spoken on that subject in the course of the campaign, some of it opinion, some of it quite forceful, none of that shows up in her figures anywhere. There's nothing about school integration. There's nothing about busing of students. None of that shows up. There was quite a bit of attack on Lyndon Johnson in the course of the campaign, being the outgoing president. None of that, as far as I know, shows up in her statistics. What I'm saying is that if this purports to be a study of how we handled the 1968 campaign, it has failed to take into account huge sections of the 1968 campaign that we covered. You are getting a distorted view of how we covered the total campaign. Beyond that, and I think the point I'm about to make is the second most important point, the first, of course, being the bizarre, what I consider bizarre classification of material. The second most important point is that nowhere in her study or in her conclusions about the study does she attempt to relate what we reported to the flow of news. That is, to the events that are being reported on. And maybe I'd better talk a little bit about how the the program at issue here, in my case, the CBS Evening News, is put together. The CBS Evening News is basically a hard news, what we call a hard news broadcast, a spot news broadcast. It deals with breaking events. And typically, it deals with events that happened during the preceding 12 hours. There are exceptions to that. We run some features. We run some what we call enterprisers and what Variety would call mini-documentaries. But the bulk of the program is breaking news. And this is especially true in a campaign period because the flow of news during a campaign period is substantially greater than normal, and there's less room for the features and less room for the miniature documentaries. So the bulk of what is on the broadcast on any given day depends pretty much on what has happened during that given day. Well, think what that means. It means that if one candidate is more active than another, he is more likely to be on the news. It means that if a candidate is giving a new speech instead of an old speech, he is more likely to be on the news. It means that if a candidate is expressing opinion and the other candidate is not expressing opinion, then obviously the one candidate is likely to have more opinion on the news. You may question why 12 hours, why we do not reflect the entire 24-hour period between the last time we were on the air and the next time we were on the air. Normally what happens is this. If an event happens in the evening, if it happens after our deadline, say after 7 o'clock at night, it is normally filmed and carried on the CBS Morning News the next morning, which granted comparatively few people see. It's not 6 o'clock, it's 7 o'clock. The audience is not particularly great for it. But the CBS Morning News also serves as a syndication service for CBS-affiliated stations around the country. What they can do and what they do is to lift pieces off the morning news and insert them in their local newscasts. And they do this all day long. If they have a show at noon, which most of them do, they'll run it there. And they'll repeat it on their evening newscasts, which typically either immediately precede or immediately follow the CBS Evening News. And I think if you're talking about the whole spectrum of where people get their political information from, you have to include those local broadcasts also, because if you've watched local newscasts, you know they include a great deal of network-originated material. And we've pretty much decided not to repeat things from the morning news unless there is an awfully compelling reason to do so, because that will have been seen all over the place by the time we go on the air, and in many cases seen immediately preceding the CBS Evening News. I just wanted to explain the logistics there. But what I'm saying is that, effectively, what we had on the air on Cronkite during the course of that 68 campaign in terms of campaign activity was what had happened during that day, during the preceding 12 hours. There are exceptions, but basically that's it. And if you're going to judge the bias with which we covered that campaign, you have to judge it against the flow of material available to us during that campaign. Now, if you think back to the 68 campaign, you'll recall a few things. You'll recall that for the bulk of the campaign, the Republicans were well ahead in the polls, and Nixon and the Republicans were conducting a relatively high-road, low-profile campaign. But the Democrats, on the other hand, were out on the road campaigning like mad. And I think it's probable that on the evening news, over that period, we had more Democrat campaigning than Republican. I don't know that we did, but I suspect we did. And if we did, because that's the way the news was flowing, I suspect it would show up somehow in the statistics of pro and anti coverage. You may recall also that President Nixon was doing a lot of evening appearances, including his paid politicals, the panel discussions he had around the country. Those typically would not show up on the evening news because they happened past our deadline. We ran a little study counting column space in the New York Daily News, which has a deadline roughly equivalent to ours. And we found, granted this is awful rough research, it's not sophisticated, but we found that Humphrey got more space in the New York Daily News over the course of those 7 weeks than Nixon did. And the New York Daily News can hardly be accused of being a radical lib. But it does seem to me that a responsible content analyst, having arrived at a set of figures, whether they're accurate figures or not, and we fervently dispute the accuracy of Ms. Efron's figures because of her selective process, but having arrived at a set of figures, would consider alternative explanations for them. and one of the alternative explanations for any figures on a hard news broadcast on a given day or over a period of time is the flow of news on which that broadcast is based. Ms. Efron must be aware of this. She knows the business. And there is no reference to that that I recall in her book. And she doesn't consider it or even discuss it, if even to dismiss it, as a plausible explanation of any of her findings. And yet it is a alternative that has to be considered. And I'm reasonably convinced that the news that we reported during that campaign faithfully recorded the nature of that campaign. Some of the items that Ms. Efron raised in discussion here were not basically campaign issues, but they ought to be discussed because I think there's probably some validity to them. The argument that we do not give enough airtime to extremists, I guess, that we haven't given the serious new left enough airtime, that we haven't given moderate blacks enough airtime, that we haven't given conservatives enough airtime. I don't know how you measure this, but I suspect that they could all raise a gripe about it. I would suggest, however, again, that you not take her figures too seriously in trying to document this, in that if you are trying to study our overall treatment of blacks or new leftists or conservatives or social issues for that matter, the 7 weeks immediately preceding an election are an awful time to do it, because the news is dominated, really dominated during those 7 weeks by campaigns, by people campaigning, and by arguments which are polarized, because that's the nature of a political campaign. Ms. Efron does not mention, for example, although I'm sure she's aware of it, that a few weeks before this study of hers, CBS News had aired in prime time a series of documentaries called Of Black America, which dealt with exactly what she was talking about, the problems, the aspirations, the diversity of the black population, which was widely viewed and widely acclaimed, and of which she makes, you know, it would have been nice to throw us that bone anyway. You make that even passing mention in your book. Thank you for the bone. But it's another objection of ours that if you're going to judge bias on the part of the network, you have to consider more than the hard news broadcasts, which are in part at least a reflection of breaking events, and consider the whole spectrum of network programming. And I think some of the issues that she feels we did not deal with during those 7 weeks of the CBS Evening News have over our spectrum, our whole spectrum, and over a course of time, been dealt with in somewhat greater detail than she would have you believe. Ms. Efron in the book also accuses us of violating, I think you accuse us of violating the FCC Fairness Doctrine.
No, the definition of fairness that I use is that which is in the original Fairness Doctrine. I think the FCC violates.
I see. Okay, I will let the FCC, my objection was that the FCC, as I think now requires, that in considering fairness, you consider a station's entire broadcasting rather than any one broadcast. That's
correct. They also talk about contrasting views, so that there's a million words on one side and two on the other, you got contrasting views.
I have one further small objection to Ms. Efron's technique, and then I'll shut up and we can field questions. And that is an objection to her selection of word count as an index of how we are performing an opinion. There are several things wrong with word count, we think. One, the counting of words is not, and I think she concedes this in her book, is not any measure of forcefulness. I think you can see that a well-spoken, forceful 10 words might be more effective in putting a point across than a poorly spoken 50 words. And what I'm saying is I'm not sure that word count proves that much. It's at best a very rough index of how ideas are being presented. Secondly, it fails to include the impact of picture material. And I don't see how, if you are doing any sort of a content analysis on television, you can judge it only on the basis of words. For example, Ms. Efron takes us to task in the book, and she did here today, for in effect sanctioning protesters by defining them in words that were not as forceful or oh, I'm losing words myself. By not calling them names enough, I think, you know, you say we did not describe them as leftists, for example. You take us to task in the book.
Violence?
Yeah.
The word you're not getting is euphemisms.
Okay, thank you. By using euphemisms to describe them, I think in the book you objected specifically to us describing violent demonstrators as hecklers. Dissenters, either way.
Yes.
All right. But the point is, I think dissenters was probably an unfortunate word there. But before you laugh too hard, remember that those words are being spoken against a background of pictures showing freaks throwing rocks. Well, if you've got pictures of freaks throwing rocks, it's a different situation than if you're taking those words and reading them in a newspaper. And I think over and over again, in judging television, you cannot judge it from a transcript. I've gone crazy trying to cut film from a transcript. You miss inflections, you miss gestures, you miss all sorts of things trying to work from a transcript. And I don't think it's a fair way to judge television. There's also a situation, and I haven't really done enough research on this to know how pervasive it is, but if I read your technique correctly, where you find an opinion, you are counting all the words in the sentence that contain that opinion, whether or not all of the words were opinionated.
Well,
am I correct then?
A sentence is the bottom unit, because I don't
right.
want to plug
I understand.
The words yet.
Well, what it means is that, for example, in that section I read earlier where Hubert Humphrey was denouncing Rap Brown and Stokely Carmichael and right-wing extremists and saying they wouldn't get away with it. Correct me if I'm wrong, but all of those words, including the denunciation of Rap Brown and Stokely Carmichael, were included as an anti-conservative editorial statement.
You're wrong, but I'll get around to it.
Okay. Anyway, it seems to me that Ms. Efron has done a disservice. She has done a disservice not only to network news journalism, but also to those of our critics who were hoping for something solid and responsible that they could use to support their criticism of us. And I think it would be a great mistake to go out of here waving the news twisters and chanting that at last you had something to prove your case, if indeed you agree with Ms. Efron's conclusions. We are not immune to criticism, and I think that criticism, if it's responsible and accurate and honest, is useful to us. I do not think the news twisters is useful to us.